Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The Great Salt Lake has been a preoccupation and a growing concern around here for years now. And you know why. The lake is shrinking dramatically. State leaders, lawmakers, conservation groups, even private donors have been trying to figure out how to get water back into the lake. It's a major story, but mostly it's been a local one, which is why people were caught off guard in February when President Trump sent out a Truth Social post that said, "Make the Great Salt Lake great again." I mean, it's on brand, but let's be honest, who thought Donald Trump was paying any attention to the Great Salt Lake, let alone its serious condition? But there it was in the post. President Trump saying it was, as he put it, very important to save the Great Salt Lake in Utah. He called it an environmental hazard, said it was of tremendous interest to him. And then a few weeks ago, Trump put $1 billion in his budget request to Congress for the lake. Now, what we know about all of this and how it unfolded goes back to February 21st during a governor's dinner at the White House. Governor Cox managed to get some time with the president. It was scheduled for 15 minutes and it lasted more like 90. Cox said the president did most of the talking. They discussed a lot of things, he said, college athletics, international trade. But the governor, of course, was focused on the lake, and he said the president seemed interested. So that was on a Friday night. On Saturday around noon, Trump sent out the Truth Social post. And the backstory to all of this, as you can tell, is pretty layered, not one straight line, but a series of conversations all filtered and passed along until they land with the president. But the BYU ecologist Ben Abbott, who's been studying the Great Salt Lake and warning about its decline for years, told us this week that the story actually goes back even further than that White House meeting in February.
Around 2 years ago, Grow the Flow held a fundraiser here in Holiday, Utah, and I ended up sitting next to this guy, Mark Burnett. He's the TV producer behind Survivor.
Fifth person voted out of Survivor, Cagayan.
The Voice.
Please welcome your final four.
Shark Tank.
Your ask is $212,000 for 10%, correct?
Yes.
And The Apprentice.
I have no choice. Your fight.
You know, Donald Trump's boss for 15 years. He was really, really skeptical. In fact, I left that meeting feeling like he didn't think the lake was that big of a deal. He didn't think we were the right team to help with the lake, and that he disliked me personally. A couple of days later, he calls and in 6 minutes commits a substantial financial gift. Basically, it says, "You guys need help." He had recently moved to Utah. He, on his own, realized how serious a threat this was. But also, I think, getting a sense that the state wasn't approaching this in a way that was going to win. So Mark agreed to be on our advisory board. Fast forward about a year, and I ended up at another unlikely forum, the Rocky Mountain Economics Summit. Afterwards, there's a mixer with the band. The audio's turned up to 11. It's blasting across this golf course. And Mark is there. His wife, Roma, is there. And he takes my hand and says, "I'm going to help you do this." So in the conversations after that meeting, he mentioned, you know, we need federal engagement on this. And right now, the one person who can do that is the president of the United States. I immediately thought, he is right that we need that federal overlay. And then I had no basis for assessing, okay, is this a realistic offer? What's the likelihood that this happens? Or is this something that can be pulled off? But I don't turn down offers of help. Then just a few weeks ago, we heard that the governor was going to be in D.C., the president might be available. Turns out that he asked him, "Hey, what can I help you with?" I was sitting there with my kids when I got the text that the meeting went really well. There should be a social media post soon, and it looks like it's going to be in the president's budget. I teared up. If we're serious about refilling the lake, then we need that federal support. Now, if we're engaged in a social battle, right, if this is a culture war issue, then we're going to say, no, we don't want that help. But for me, I felt like our role at Grow the Flow clearly had to be, let's make sure that this gets across the finish line. Because a social media post doesn't materialize, doesn't create $1 billion. And by the way, $1 billion doesn't automatically translate into water. We need to make sure that all of those dots are connected. From then till now, I actually believe that Great Salt Lake is the crisis that we need. In 2026, when we are more divided than ever, I think the only thing that's going to rock us out of our ruts, knock us out of these kind of ideological silos, is realizing there are problems bigger than the arguments on social media. There are even problems bigger than our personal grievances and hurts, right? And being forced to work together, I believe, creates an opportunity, not the inevitability, but it creates an opportunity for connection and for seeing each other as human beings.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, as the story of the Great Salt Lake apparently moves from a local issue to a national one, we're going to look at where the lake stands right now. And by that, I mean in the wake of a very dry winter. When you talk about the effort to save the lake, there are a few key pieces to understand. There's the condition of the lake itself, but there's also the effort to convince people it's in danger. And that's a conversation that sits in that intersection of science and politics, and it's something Ben Abbott has found himself right in the middle of. Abbott is an assistant professor of ecology at Brigham Young University, and he's the executive director of Grow the Flow. It's one of the groups working to restore the lake. Abbott has said this year could be a turning point for the Great Salt Lake. We started by talking about why he thinks so.
The acquisition of the U.S. Magnesium water is the biggest chunk of new water we have seen so far that's going to stay in the lake.
Big deal.
That makes a hydrological difference. You look at the water out in the West Desert that could begin flowing to the lake if we pierce the dikes that were built by Bangor, or plus the U.S. magnesium water, and we're in the 10 to maybe 15% of the total water we need to restore the lake. And remember, especially when the lake's low, that kind of addition can make a big difference in either its decline or rise.
Right.
So that part is just the state and then private partners were able to move really fast and secure this water. I think it's hard to overstate how important that is. That's a concrete thing that happened, again, thanks to the support of so many people, right, working with their legislators. The other thing is we now have a goal, and that goal is to have a full lake by the time the world comes to visit Utah.
So the Olympics has been a good thing. It's been a good target to shoot for.
If the only thing the Olympics does is refill Great Salt Lake, it would have been worth hosting the games.
Right.
And Brad Wilson said it best. We're not restoring the lake for the Olympics, but this is a really important point of accountability.
Yeah.
Right. When you've got a deadline, I'm a college professor. I know that
you know
put
deadlines.
Things off until the due date. Right. And so we've now got a due date.
Right.
And I look at the graph almost every day. Where's the lake level today? How far do we have to go? You know, and we're in a situation where we've got to increase the lake level by 8 feet in 8 years. With an 8-year time frame, you can't afford to waste a month, let alone a year, right? And so there has been a focusing on not just being able to say we've spent a lot of money on the lake, but tuning the policies to make them work. The third thing that's different now is with the Utah legislature and governor's office asking for federal help and coordination across the western states, we actually have the team together that could solve this, right? We have very little chance of restoring the lake if we don't have cooperation and support from Idaho and Wyoming. And HCR 9, this resolution that came out of the legislature, is really clear describing the cause of the decline of the lake, the scope of the economic investment that it's going to take, and then the people that we need to coordinate with.
Well, and it frames it as a national issue, not
That's just right. A
Utah problem. That seems to be a really critical point.
People dismiss resolutions and say, oh, it's just symbolic, right?
Right.
It doesn't change anything. Again, looking to what's going to solve this problem, it's a lot of symbols. It's a lot of people recognizing this is our lake. This is our home. This is our identity, right? What kind of people are we? And that's what I see in that piece of legislation. And it passed with almost unanimous support, right?
Can I impose a little skepticism?
Yeah, please.
As a way of pushing back a bit on maybe the political realities here. Another thing that is contained in that resolution – is this attempt to kind of sidestep heavy regulation, mandates, lean more into – and this is appealing for conservatives. You get it, right? Lean more into market-based solutions, to try to find fixes that are voluntary. Sounds like you're okay with that, maybe as a compromise, given that you're in the position to have to compromise.
Yeah. You know, I think we should be under no illusions. Yeah. Utah, as a conservative state, isn't going to step up to the level of regulation until we've exhausted the possibility of markets and voluntary compensated transactions, right? Like, let's try that as rigorously as we can. Let's get the money behind it. Let's get the programs behind it. If we create a system that works for farmers, guess what? Farmers are some of the most sophisticated thinkers in our community, thinking about probability, weather, climate, markets, right? We need to have a system that works for farmers. And so far, the water market has been completely hobbled by red tape, right? I mean, we have not seen adoption. It's just starting to gain steam right now. And these modifications to how farmers can now fast track those transactions, they can be compensated if they forego a cutting of alfalfa, if they conserve water, right? Now that incentive is in place. That I think of that as the motor, and then the money is the fuel, right? Now we've got to really rev up the RPMs.
I want to ask about how your perspective and your approach, your own sort of strategy for how to deal with this crisis has changed over the years. I think people who followed your work have noticed a kind of shift in tone. It comes out in the documentary The Lake, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. You go from this sort of intense sense of activism, being openly critical of policymakers not doing enough, to what seems like you've transitioned to sort of more of a sense of collaboration, shared responsibility, using language that's sort of shifted away from blame to collective action, the idea of stewardship, the idea of, you know, supporting leaders despite where they might be politically. So can you just talk a little bit about – and I guess what I'm wondering is, was it a shift that you sort of came to intellectually? Was it shaped by the real experiences? Do you mind talking about that?
Absolutely. When Bonnie and I led this very controversial 2023 report, right, that pointed out the potential 5-year timeline for collapse of the lake, if you read to the end of that report, it is shot through with hope and shared action, praise and trust, right? Recognizing the work that had been done. Now, that 5-year timeline was the main thing that
people were just freaked out by the 5 years. They didn't notice the fact that you were talking about
this was a call to really work together. And the initial response of the legislature, of the governor, of a bunch of others was really encouraging. And you know, there was a period there for a little bit over a year where I really thought we were off to the races, and I became much more pessimistic after that. So I think I started in a similar place where I am now, where, okay, we are all on the same team. We literally are all in the same big bowl perched up in the mountains. Like, we got to fix this together, to a feeling of like, wow, we are not on track. And we're not even going in the right direction. So I went through that valley of the shadow of death, seeing because of a political cycle, because of these two water years that were above average, us really losing
that people
focus.
Were not paying attention anymore because they were shoveling their sidewalks during the snowstorms. Yes, okay.
In the 50th snowstorm of that year, you start to think, okay, maybe we want the lake to dry out. A little bit less snow would be nice. I became really discouraged and alarmed. And I do want to say, I don't believe that it is that it's unhelpful criticism when we point out the facts. Like, we have to – this is an emergency, and we have to constantly ground ourselves in what is the evidence telling us. So I would defend for myself and anyone else, when you see something, say something, right? So that's going to be interpreted as unhelpful, as critical by some, but my lane as a scientist needs to stay there, right? And so we are headed toward an all-time low this summer. But we may just brush against it. We may crash through it, depending on what happens over the next few months. But we have not yet turned the corner. We haven't yet fixed the problem, right? No number of social media posts or podcasts can fix this problem. We've got to get more water to the lake. Until that happens, it will continue to decline. So
what's the obstacle? What's the main thing in the way of all of that? So you can do all of this, you say, soften the ground with podcasts and conversations and gatherings. As you say, the president can do a social media post. But what's the thing that's not happening then?
You know, let's start from the mechanics. We have built one of the most complex machines in the world right here in this watershed. It was mainly built by the federal government, but it is a series of dams and pipelines, canals and sprinklers that are unprecedented. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you spend some time on Google Earth and zoom around, you find these canals going through urban areas. And you're like, where is that water even going? Right? It's this history, this incredibly sophisticated system to keep water from flowing to Great Salt Lake. Think about what has to happen for a flake of snow that falls in the mountains to get to the lake. It has to run through all of those barriers. I mean, it's tighter than the Strait of Hormuz right now. Like, it's really hard for the water to get there. So we have to have the federal managers of these dams agree to let water flow through that the state has acquired, right? That's been a very difficult transaction. They've got project water that's reserved for certain uses. So there's an administrative barrier there. Farmers often are working across state boundaries and then with multiple entities, right? Their irrigation company, the Bear River Compact, multiple layers of laws, right? We have built a physical system and a legal system that does not include Great Salt Lake. And so just acknowledging how difficult it is for water to run that gauntlet and get there, it gives you a sense of it's not enough to make an announcement. Look, when Lake Urmia started to decline, this is a lake almost exactly the same size as Great Salt Lake. The former supreme leader, rest in peace, Ayatollah Khamenei, announced 5 times that he was going to save that lake. He spent $1 billion, which, think about that, for a country crippled by international sanctions, was a huge investment. And the lake just continued to decline, right? They weren't able to pull those straws out of the groundwater, to shut off those diversions from the river, to change how people were using water. So it's a huge lift.
Why weren't they able to?
They focused on water augmentation was one of the huge mistakes they made, right? They went big on cloud seeding. They also focused on trying to dig a new river channel to the lake rather than restoring flow to Lake Urmia. They said, okay, we're going to bring in new water from the mountains, right? That hydrologically, it doesn't work. My colleague Brigham Daniels always says, did you know there already are 3 pipelines that flow to Great Salt Lake? The Bear River, the Jordan River, the Weber River. The pipelines are already there. We just got to fill them with water, right? And we do that through conservation.
That's Ben Abbott. He's an assistant professor of ecology at Brigham Young University, the executive director of the nonprofit group Grow the Flow. Take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Great Salt Lake and asking how a dry winter is adding pressure to an already strained ecosystem. The lake usually peaks in late May. This year, it's already topped out. And then there's the Donald Trump angle to the story. The president has included in his budget $1 billion for the lake. But as we've heard, it's hard to turn money into water. Let's get back to our conversation with Ben Abbott. This $1 billion is now in the president's budget.
Yeah.
But the budget is a guideline. It's a suggestion. Yeah. It's not approved by Congress. Congress still has to decide whether any of it actually becomes law, any of it actually makes it to Utah. The amount could change. The dynamics could change. One of the things you've mentioned is Utah's got to land the fish. So what are you thinking about the prospects of all of that? How are you thinking about that part now of this?
We need the public to be engaged right now because the president's budget, as you say, it's just a suggestion, right? And the Appropriations Committee and the Senate and House at the federal level are going to decide if money is actually dedicated to this. We need that to happen. Again, regardless of your political stripes, please reach out to your federal senator and representative, right? We need there to be absolute unanimity. If you live in Idaho, your voice matters even more. Hmm. Reach out to your senator, representative, and governor and say, Great Salt Lake affects us. These dust storms, they don't respect state boundaries, right? The decrease in precipitation we're seeing as the lake shrinks, that doesn't stay in Utah, right? That affects areas outside of Utah. So we need anybody within earshot to say, I want to support this. And then at the same time, we need to work through our networks to make sure that the federal leaders who are going to make those decisions include. There's a crucial but easy step, which is getting it in the congressional budget.
Mm-hmm.
So that it turns into real money. There is a much harder and more important step after that, and that's making sure that money translates into water.
Well, this is one of the things you often say, that it's hard to do that, to translate money into water.
Yeah.
Explain what you mean. What's that next step then?
The governor and legislature often say, we've spent $1 billion, you know, on water generally and sometimes even associated with Great Salt Lake. We can't yet measure the increase in inflow to the lake from that investment. And that's not an indictment, right? There's a lot of groundwork that needs to happen. But take, for example, a medium-sized city in the watershed, Ogden City. We could easily spend $1 billion just upgrading Ogden City's pipes. Right? Water infrastructure is incredibly expensive. So if we take a hard path engineering approach to this, like let's get a pipeline from the Snake River, or let's really scale up the state's cloud seeding program, which has no independent scientific evidence that it's working, right? We could easily spend $1 billion without increasing water flow. On the other hand, if we focus on education that encourages conservation, do you know what the decrease in water consumption was in the Salt Lake County between 2023 and 2021 and 2022?
No.
In a single year, as the county focused on conservation, there was a 30% decrease in how much water people were using.
Wow.
For a few $100,000 of public relations, education, connecting people to this, behaviors changed. Similarly, we need to supercharge this agricultural water leasing and acquisition program, right, that the Watershed Enhancement Trust is leading, the Great Salt Lake Commissioner's Office is leading. We need boots on the ground.
Yeah, what do you mean by boots on the ground? What exactly do you mean by that?
So the closest thing we have to success with these terminal lakes is Walker Lake in Nevada. Very small lake, a fraction of the size of Great Salt Lake. There are a few hundred water users in the entire watershed. But Harry Reid, the former senator from Nevada, he was very effective at getting money, hundreds of millions of dollars, oriented toward the restoration of Walker Lake. They took a very similar approach to what Utah's doing right now. Let's compensate farmers. Let's incentivize conservation. Let's do leasing. Let's do water purchasing. Let's help farmers transition to more water-wise crops using better technology. Same thing for cities. They had a staff the same size as the Great Salt Lake Commissioner's office. In our case, there are three orders of magnitude more people living here. We have hundreds of thousands of major water users. We've got to get real about the human resources needed to solve this problem, right? It isn't just a declaration. It's not even a change in state code or federal policy. We need people speaking with farmers, supporting them, right? It's been interesting. I've heard that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has called some senior missionaries to actually go out into the community and help farmers understand, here is what's changed, right? Here's some legal assistance that you can get to remove that barrier, right? Even if you've heard the laws changed, are you going to make that huge economic risk of changing how you're managing your water if you're not sure that that's going to pan out? No, that's going to be a big obstacle. You need that legal support. So I think that one of the most impactful things that we could do is really right-size the team. Hire the kinds of people that we need. And it's really encouraging to see the support on the private sector side too, which is bringing needed capacity there on the innovation, investment, acquiring water side of things. But we also need the agency to be the right size. And so I think growing Brian Steed's Great Salt Lake Commissioner's office would be hugely impactful. And we need that, right, to effectively spend out that money. There's an idea of, oh, no, you don't want to spend anything on overhead, but actually the evidence shows you want to spend about 20% of the overall investment on overhead to make sure that those investments are being used wisely. that they are the most impactful that they can be.
Let me briefly come back to a political dimension here and just ask you whether or not you think that Donald Trump's, to some, surprising support, that social media post, his apparent enthusiasm about doing something about this, is that going to make a difference? Just in a red state, I just wonder if you think what difference that is going to make in the larger picture, I guess.
So if you've got a difference with somebody, you don't feel trust between you, let's just say that generally.
Yeah.
If there's something that's really important that you can work on, very often you bridge that divide. If you think that they're just trying to claim credit for something, they're parachuting in and saying, hey, I did this. Let's roll out a banner that says mission accomplished. That's really different. I believe that this offer of federal assistance is real. We've already seen it translate from a social media post to a line item in a budget. I understand that there is lobbying and outreach going on to try to get Congress on board. Again, we need that from every Utah citizen as well as people around the country. Can we come together and save this lake? What government does isn't just government, right? It's a reflection of our values as the people. Hmm. So this really could make a difference, and I'd argue it already has. In just a few days after the president's social media post, we saw a joint resolution from the legislature and the governor's office, which for the first time recognized the scale of the problem, asked for federal coordination, called on the states of Idaho, Wyoming, and Nevada to be a part of the rescue. This is a huge change from where we were just months ago. And so, again, I'm the last person to say I'm going to turn away that help, right? People that are not going to listen to me are going to listen to Donald Trump. And so if he's talking about this in a helpful way, if he's using his political force in a helpful way, I welcome that. I want to support that.
One of the things that you have talked about is – this is how you've put it. Winning slowly is losing. What does that mean in practical terms right now? Where do you see progress that's just not fast enough in the interest of – finding collaboration in getting everyone of all political stripes together on board? Are you worried that you sacrifice a little bit of urgency and that you have to keep maybe coming in every once in a while and just raising a red flag every once in a while? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think that involving the president in this is a compromise that decreases the urgency. In fact, it's the only accelerant that can save the lake on the timeframe we need. Right? Are we going to resign ourselves?
So you think quite the opposite. You think it's an accelerator.
Opposite.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's that African adage of when you need to go fast, go slow. Right. Get the right people together. Prepare the wagon. Mm-hmm. Right, for the sprint. And if we're serious about this problem, we've got to welcome the help. And then if we say no, sorry, I don't agree on these other issues, what we do is we peel off that critical perspective. Because look, we need skeptics. We need people who are willing to say, wait, we've spent over $200 million on agricultural optimization. That's translated to zero additional gallons, let alone acre feet of water flowing to the lake.
Yeah.
Right? That's just a fact. That's not a criticism saying we shouldn't have done that, but it didn't solve the problem that it was aiming toward. Now, it's been helpful to some farmers for sure. And now that program is oversubscribed. It creates some water that we can use to start fixing the next stage of the problem. So it isn't like it was a complete waste, but it hasn't had the impact we need. So having the president on board as a booster that's going to align some political actors who don't listen to Radio West, who aren't going to listen to a college professor of any political background, that's really, really helpful.
About a month or so ago, I think it was in January, the governor said the Great Salt Lake will be full again by the time of the Winter Olympics and Paralympics when they return in 2034. Right now, as you make the assessment, are we on track?
Bonnie Baxter said it best. We're on the right road, but we're 20 years behind.
Yeah.
Right. So but there is going to be a tipping point, which I believe could happen this year, with concerted efforts toward urban and agricultural water conservation. with leadership from the faith community, from the private sector. We could, this could be the all-time low for the lake this year. And next year we could see, even regardless of what the weather does, we could see an increase in lake level. It is not the snow drought that's causing the decline of Great Salt Lake. In fact, a shrunken lake is one of the contributors that caused the snow drought, right? We don't have that source of water vapor. The lake is very well adapted to dealing with wet years and dry years. What it can't tolerate is chronic overuse of water, right? We've turned down the tap that keeps the lake full. We've got to open up that tap. It is not going to happen automatically, but I actually believe that the snow drought is maybe an answer to prayers as well, because it focuses us. People realize, wait, we are so far off the charts. I looked about a week ago. We had half as much snow for that date as the previous all-time low, right? We blew the all-time low out of the water. This is a clear sign. We're not going to get a series of wet years that just gets us out of jail free, right? We have to look at what is causing the lake's decline. The lake is 15 feet lower than it would be because of our use of water. Even with the millennial drought, the lower precipitation since around the year 2000, it would be solidly in the healthy range. In fact, near the top of the healthy range right now. So we've got to be crystal clear about what has caused the lake's decline, and then very practical and say, look, the water users throughout the watershed, they're not going to change political party in the next few years. Right? Most of them are not going to change their profession, right? We've got to work in the system that's here. We should also have a long view and say, look, as people realize that conserving water isn't an end of their way of life. In fact, that is the pathway to continued beautiful urban environments, productive farmlands. That the only way that we continue that, and we've seen real leadership from the Utah Department of Food and Ag talking about, we want to continue farming in this region, and we recognize that we've got to evolve, right? That people are unified right now. And so I think that each day I wake up and say, how can I build that momentum, right? What can I do individually? What can we do as a community to keep that ball rolling? Because we are announcement to restore the lake by the Olympics, that is not the finish line. Right, that's the starting gun that just went off, and we've got to be ready for a sprint followed by a marathon.
Ben Abbott, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Ben Abbott, he's an assistant professor of ecology at Brigham Young University. When we get back from a break, we'll hear from Bonnie Baxter about the condition of the lake itself and the fragile ecosystem around it. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the Great Salt Lake and how a dry winter has added pressure to that already strained system. We've discussed how this issue has moved through the political arena, including a $1 billion proposal from President Trump in his budget. But let's get back to the lake itself and the conditions on the ground. For that, we turn to Bonnie Baxter. She's a professor of biology at Westminster University and director of the Great Salt Lake Institute. How are you thinking about the lake right now? And by that, I mean in the wake of a really dry, scary winter.
Yeah, I think this winter has been a little bit terrifying. It was kind of the opposite of that winter that came in 23.
Yeah.
We have hit our high water mark. Last month, we hit our high water mark. And we usually hit the high in the end of May or the beginning of June. So to hit that in March is just terrifying. We got a lot of precipitation last fall, which was really helpful because that directly rained into the lake. Mm. But in terms of runoff, we're just not getting any this year. It's terrible.
What does it mean? Tell us what it means that the peak water level happened too early. Does that mean just longer time for evaporation, those kinds of things?
Yeah. So Great Salt Lake is very shallow. It's kind of more like a saucer than a bowl, mm-hmm. and it has a lot of water in contact with the air. And so the evaporation rate is pretty high in terms of if the lake were deeper, and had less water in contact with the air, it wouldn't evaporate so readily. So evaporation is something that's normal in the cycle of a terminal lake. During a precipitation season, you get inflow, and that inflow of water equals, you know, X. And then during the evaporation season, which is the summer, primarily into the fall, you get this evaporation, and that should also be equal to X. And then those two numbers should match to keep the lake at the same level. And unfortunately, those two numbers do not match, and we consistently get less inflow than we get evaporation. Last year, we only got 1.2 feet inflow, and evaporation was, you know, like 2.8 feet, close to three. So if you just keep the number three in your head, we've got to at least get 3 feet of inflow, because we're going to get 3 feet of evaporation. So that cycle is normal, but those numbers that are out of balance, that's not normal.
But how much of that cycle is exacerbated by heat, dust on the snow, just a longer, warmer season? I guess how much of the lake's decline now comes from increased evaporation versus that reduced inflow, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because as the lake recedes, the environment out there changes.
Yeah.
The topology of the lake bottom changes because now you've got less of a lake. So therefore, the amount of water percentage-wise that's in contact with the air changes. So I think that's just constantly in flux. And it's hard to measure because of that. And that's why we go to key indicators like inflow from rivers that we can measure and evaporation rates we can think of in terms of the reduction in elevation, how the elevation goes down. It's kind of hard because it's a constantly changing lake. So setting this up, how we got here, more and more people move to this watershed and start using more and more water for development, for agriculture, for industry. The more and more people using more and more water, and they're diverting the water in the watershed before it gets to the puddle at the bottom, which is Great Salt Lake. So that's the first thing that happened. But then we started meeting the stressors of climate change. As the temperatures get hotter in the summer, we have a higher evaporation rate. And then we also shrink the lake more, right? So then we expose more shoreline. And then if we expose more shoreline, we have the possibility of generating dust that then can land on any snowpack that we have and change what's called the albedo, the reflectivity of the snow. And so now the snow is absorbing sunlight and getting really warm and melting more quickly. And then you get water that runs off on the surface as opposed to water that permeates the ground and restores the aquifers and slowly makes its way down to Great Salt Lake. So if you have that situation, water that runs off on the surface actually has a higher evaporation rate than water that's down in the ground. That's why sprinkling your lawn is terrible, but flushing is probably okay. So you can flush, just don't sprinkle your lawn because it's in contact with the air and then you lose water to evaporation.
So it seems like what you're saying is, I mean, one of the things you hear from advocates of the lake is that the lake is low because of diversions, not just because of climate change. But what you're saying is those two things do play out together.
Yeah. And synergistically,
in
a negative way. So they work together to make this quite a catastrophe in the making. So I like to think that the way I think about it is that the diversions happened first. And now we're meeting the challenges of climate change. But both things are at play. And there's even a third thing. We're in a normal mega drought cycle in the Southwest. Every 1,200 years or so, there's a drought that lasts decades. We know this from records of tree rings and soil hydration studies. And now we're in another one of those cycles. So I see it as three things. It's kind of the perfect storm. Humans have set this up by diverting water. Now we've got the pressures of climate change, and we're in a historic mega drought. That doesn't mean we won't occasionally have a good water year, but it means almost every other year will be really, really a bad deficit.
One of the things you've been talking about is that there's a lot of data now being thrown around, and it's really complicated. And so you're trying to sort of parse out the meaning of it. So let's talk a little bit about the data. First of all, you have something like 63 monitoring sites, you have, you know, improved data. Are we getting closer to that data giving us a sense of what exactly to do, or is it just now telling us how complex that ecosystem is?
I am involved in several state agency committees that work on monitoring various parts of the lake. So the monitoring that the Division of Wildlife does is looking at the brine shrimp and brine flies population. So I work on their technical advisory group, and the Forestry, Fire, and State Lands Agency, they have a salinity advisory committee that I also sit on. And so through those committees, I've learned various ways to look at the parameters of the lake and monitor its health. We have determined a healthy salinity for the lake ecosystem of the South Arm. USGS monitors the nutrients around the lake and reports back to these committees. We monitor the health of the brine shrimp population, the number of brine fly larvae that are in the water column. And then that doesn't even get me into the bird monitoring that happens through the Department of Wildlife and also through some private orgs in town. So there's a lot of monitoring now that's happening on the lake and a lot of data, like you point to. So what do you do with it, right? I think one of the most interesting things is how we are navigating the salinity extremes that come with a shrinking lake.
Let me ask about salinity. So officials, for people who just don't know, they've been trying to manage salinity in the lake by adjusting how water moves between the North and the South Arms. So you've got things like, you know, modifying this railroad causeway breach and using berms. So talk a little bit about how that strategy is working and what you're seeing as a result in the ecosystem.
Yeah, I kind of did a deep dive recently on the history of the berm. In 2017, the state put together this salinity advisory committee, and I was asked to participate. And I joined up thinking it would be, I don't know, a six-month appointment. And it ends up being that it goes on and on for years. So this body has been really crucial to understanding how salinity could be managed on the lake. But it was spurred on by an agreement between Union Pacific Railroad, who owns the causeway, and the state of Utah, Forestry, Fire, State Lands. So they had lots of discussions between those two bodies. And the agreement, when they built the new breach in the causeway, the new hole that will allow boats to go through and would allow the water to exchange between North and South Arm, which it really hadn't done very well since it was built in 1960. So they were building a new breach, and they built into the plans what they called an adaptable berm. I kept waiting for the railroad to present their fancy engineering scheme that was going to help us manage this breach. And I went to this meeting and they revealed it. I was so excited. And it turned out that the fancy engineering was a pile of rocks, which I find hilarious. But when we did get to the point where we were having a salinity spike in the South Arm in 22, we were able to quickly on that committee say, well, how high should we build a pile of rocks? Because that heavy water in the North Arm will seep down and be blocked by the pile of rocks while the South Arm water flows over the top of it. And so it actually cuts off the pink water from coming back into the South Arm. And it's crazy that that works. It's such a simple piece of engineering. But at this elevation where we are right now at 4192 and a bit, We were at this elevation in 2021, and the salinity was around 16% to 17%. And right now, it's at 12%.
Wow.
So this pile of rocks is working.
When you go out there, explain what you see. Can you tell that how the lake is responding to stress? Is the lake trying to adapt to a new kind of reality in scary ways or surprising ways? What do you see?
Well, I think the upside of what we see right now is like so many brine flies. I haven't seen this many brine flies in years and years.
Wow.
Because we're managing the salinity. And those brine flies like the salinity to be between 10 and 12%. That's their happy place. And so as long as we're managing the salinity in that zone, we're just going to have robust flies, and they feed more birds than the brine shrimp. So it's really important that we see that. So that's the positive side. The negative side is those flies are having to attach to other things because the microbialites are disappearing for them. They need the microbialites to be underwater in order to attach to them in order to do their life cycle. So the microbialites are being beached. And in that case, then the flies are like trying to latch on to little pieces of debris in the lake. We find them on strings. And so that's not going to be sustainable. As we lose more microbialites, we're going to start to lose the flies.
Hmm. Will you say something, if you want, about what now seems to be the possibility of federal money and the Trump administration's interest, Donald Trump's social media post about the lake?
Yeah, I think what I might have to say initially, my initial reaction might surprise folks, but I think it's an indicator of how we in Utah are all moving in the same direction together. Mm-hmm. Everybody is in agreement. Farmers, people in industry around the lake, the brine shrimpers, artists, state agency scientists, federal agency folks, Donald Trump, Governor Cox, everybody is in agreement that we need to save Great Salt Lake and we need to get more water to the lake. Where the disagreement comes is how do you turn this $1 billion that President Trump has put in his congressional budget proposal for the lake. How do you turn that into water? And I've been sort of keeping close tabs on the ideas that are being talked about. And some of them are big infrastructure projects. So I know it's a great idea to build something big and then you can point to it and say, look, we got a bunch of money and we built this big thing. But if we build a pipeline, like the actual upkeep costs become a burden for the taxpayers of Utah for years and years to come. And I think that that's something that we really ought to think about.
So one of the things that we seem to have now is with the Olympics coming as a kind of goal, like increase the lake level by, 8 feet in 8 years. And I guess my final question is, are we on track? One of the things you've said is that we're on the right road, but we're 20 years behind. Are we catching up? Are we on the right track? That's what I want to ask finally.
I'll say two things. One, having a goal is really, really important. The goal that Governor Cox chose, the level of 4198, is a level set by the Salinity Advisory Council. So I was involved in setting that number and deciding what lake level is scientifically proven to be healthy for the lake. So the number and the goal are scientifically sound. So that's fantastic. And having a goal like that, that's backed up by science, is brilliant. So I'm grateful. But anybody can say anything. It's the doing that's complicated. And so we've got to keep on the plan. We've got to keep on the doing. And the cheapest way to get there is not building things. The cheapest way is to conserve water. That's the fastest way. That's the cheapest way. So if we're going to work on the timeline of Great Salt Lake and we really want to save it, I think we need to really take water conservation measures much more seriously than building something that's going to take years and be sustained by decades of financing. I'm all for water conservation.
Bonnie Baxter, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Bonnie Baxter, she's a professor of biology at Westminster University and director of the Great Salt Lake Institute. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can also email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.